This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 29th of October, 2014, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up on today's show, from Hong Kong to Erdogan, to the Baltics to Ebola, we'll talk through the day's top stories with veteran news correspondent Jeffrey Kaufman and former British diplomat Jim Hoare. Then our Monocle's Tristan McAllister joins us from our New York bureau for a roundup of the day's transport news.
We'll look at changes to New York City's bike-sharing ownership, Boeing's big news in the Middle East, and a floating train between D.C. and the Big Apple.
And later in the show...
My son was taken. I came back.
It's been 8 years now. What are the chances of finding him alive?
There's nothing else there. No proof, no evidence.
You need to stop this. You need to go home.
I found something.
We'll look at the highs and lows of recent TV releases with Jasper Rees from the Arts Desk. All that and much more, all to come on Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. So lots to get through over the next 58 and a half minutes here from Studio One. First, though, the world news with Suzanne Chislett.
Monocle 24 News. The World Health Organization says the number of new Ebola cases in Liberia may have plateaued. The decline in the number of burials and confirmed cases is the first sign that efforts to halt the spread of the virus in the worst affected nations is making progress. While aid agencies say much more help is needed to complete the task and to help those who've suffered because of the outbreak, WHO's Assistant Director General Bruce Aylward says the figures should be broadly welcomed.
The actual number of newly reported cases is beginning to decline in Liberia, and the government is really driving a multi-pronged investigation, looking at multiple strands of evidence to try and understand, is this real? Is this a reporting phenomena? Or is it even a care-seeking phenomena that's changing?
Iraqi security forces are now within a few miles of the city of Beji, following a renewed offensive to retake the country's biggest oil refinery. It's been largely in control of Islamic State militants since June. In Turkey, Kurdish Peshmerga forces are now nearing the Syrian town of Kobani, where they plan to join local troops to try to prevent IS taking the area. Monocle 24's Caleb Lauer in Istanbul says Ankara took some time to agree to allow them to travel through its territory.
Turkey has been denying support for Kobani for so long, and now it's essentially facilitating support for Kobani. What did Turkey get in exchange? What was the deal? This is a question that's on everybody's mind. The other thing to remember is that despite the fact that there are now deals in place between the PYD, which is defending Kobani, and Barzani's Peshmerga, and Barzani's the government of northern Iraq, these groups are rivals and have been rivals for a long, long time.
More than 100 people are thought to have been killed by a landslide in central Sri Lanka. Scores of homes were buried after heavy monsoon rains caused the slip in the tea-growing region. At least 300 people are still unaccounted for. In Zambia, the Vice President Guy Scott has now been sworn in as interim leader, following the death in London of President Michael Sata. The 77-year-old had been receiving medical treatment for an unknown condition. Elections will take place within the next 3 months. But in the meantime, Zambia now has Africa's first white leader since the end of apartheid. These people in the capital, Lusaka, gave their reactions.
I don't see it as a serious case for him to be or not to be a president, but he is automatically has to be a president.
I think Mr. Guy Scott is qualified to do that, the job, because they wouldn't have chosen him to be vice president if he was not qualified to do that.
He's not right. You know, 50 years after independence, I think we're supposed to have our own indigenous person acting in that position. Because this actually puts the country in a very awkward position.
France has denied claims by Russia that it's preparing to deliver the delayed Mistral-class assault ship next month. The handover of the first of two built for Moscow was suspended after international pressure on Paris because of Russia's role in the Ukraine crisis. A Russian official said plans for a handover ceremony were underway, but President Francois Hollande says he's not yet made a decision on how the 1.2 billion euro contract will progress. The world's third busiest airport, Heathrow in London, expects to report higher passenger numbers this year than previously estimated. The five terminal site, which is owned by Spain's Ferrovial and other partners, now says 73.4 million people are likely to have travelled through by the end of 2014. That would be a 0.8% increase on its earlier forecast, 1.5% up on last year. And a Russian-launched spacecraft has successfully docked with the International Space Station a day after a US commercially made rocket exploded just after takeoff in Virginia. The Progress vehicle took off from Kazakhstan. It's carried water, air, and other equipment to the crew of the ISS. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Suzanne. You're listening to Midori House. Time here in London, it's just 18.05, gone 18.06. It's 14.06 in Washington, D.C.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And joining me now in the studio with their take on the day's news is the veteran network television news correspondent, also fellow countryman, and a regular contributor, Jeffrey Kaufman, and the academic and historian, Jim Hoare, a former British diplomat based in Seoul, Beijing, and Pyongyang. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Good day.
Good day. I want to start in the Baltic, not literally. We'll stay here in Studio One.
Yes, rather.
Yesterday, we saw German Eurofighter jets, gentlemen, scrambled after seven Russian military jets were spotted flying in international airspace. Of course, this is the latest in a very long line of similar incidents, probably not just in the region. We've seen similar interdictions also with Japan as well. Also, we had that potentially sort of mysterious sub that might have been in Swedish waters. Jeffrey, I want to start with you. Is it almost a subtle return to, reminds me of those images that we used to see in the newspapers when, you know, American F-15s were sort of scrambled and we saw sort of the big, you know, multi-propped Russian bear bombers off the coast of Alaska and things like that. And this, you know, that was a constant scene from, you know, the mid-80s and certainly before that. Does this become a running theme now?
It does feel a little bit like Cold War 2.0, but I think on a much diminished scale. But nonetheless, I don't think we can be too trivial about it. I think that Putin, we already know, is kind of a caged tiger, feeling very, very frustrated by the constraints of the diminished Soviet Union. We've seen so much of his aggression in Ukraine. These little transgressions, if there was a sub in Swedish waters, we are clearly there have been airplanes with more frequency over the borders of the Baltic states. It's hard not to see them as little tests and ways to see what NATO and its and the Baltic countries and their NATO allies will do. I mean, the sad thing about this is that one of the great dividends of the Cold War was the peace dividend, that these countries didn't have to spend so much on their military. And now, of course, with this kind of creeping aggression on the part of the Russians, there's anxiety in Sweden and Finland and the Baltic states and really all the way down through Eastern Europe, which is only, you know, these countries which spend about 1% of their GDP are now ramping up to 2% and sometimes 3%. Mm. That's money that could go to much more constructive things. Mm.
Jim, how do you view this? And it's interesting just listening to the bulletin as well, because here Russia's almost jumping up and down with excitement that they might also get at least the first of one of their two French-made aircraft carriers as well.
Well, I would agree that this is an upping of the game a bit. But remember, others do it as well. The Chinese and the Americans play this sort of game off the coast of China. And it's threatening, but it's not necessarily going to lead to anything further. But it's just, I think in the case of the Baltic states, particularly the ones that were formerly part of the Soviet Union, and Finland but also, you know, reminding them that we're here and we're big and we matter and you were stupid to join NATO. I suspect there's some of that in it.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's not just that these small countries that don't spend much money on their defences are here, it is also the NATO presence as well.
Right, and it brings in Article 5 of NATO, which Ukraine, of course, couldn't elect to use because it's not part of NATO, which is that an attack on one country is an attack on all 28. And clearly that kind of sits in the back of particularly the tiny Baltics, that if my research is correct, that between the three countries they have one tank, which is a 1955 Soviet-era tank.
Right. And of course, they do have rotating NATO deployments. So, you know, the Dutch have been in there and the Germans. And of course, they're deployed there with these forward operating bases right now. But I mean, Jeffrey, well, I guess to both of you, but I mean, Jeffrey, I'll start with you. I mean, do you think it is particularly to produce a few beads of sweat on brows in Vilnius, in Tallinn, in Riga?
Well, you know, I just think that it's really about the resurgence of Greater Russia and trying to remind people that the Soviets are not content with a diminished state place in the world.
All the Russians, as we say now.
Right, exactly. The former Soviets. Thank you. Yes, I'm dating myself. but you know, I think I agree. It's hard to imagine Putin really sending the tanks in as he did in Georgia. And trying to test NATO's will, because when you start something like that, you really don't know where it's going to end up, and you know, God forbid.
What you're seeing, in a sense, is also that what happens when a big empire and a land empire breaks up into some of its component parts. There are problems left over from the past, like the large Russian communities that exist in all these countries. Some of them are quite well integrated. You go to somewhere like Kyrgyzstan, and most of the Russians say, we don't want to go to Russia, we're happy here, we've lived here all our lives. Others are less integrated, or may feel that things have gone downhill for them since the end of the Soviet Union, and they look to Moscow to support them, and there's an element of that as well. Plus, every time Putin's pushed somewhere and told off somewhere, he might well react by doing this sort of little bit of pressure point.
And he doesn't really. The interesting thing is he could send tanks in if he really felt like testing the waters. But if he really wants to strangle these countries, he just has to turn off the pipelines that supply oil and gas to these countries, and they'll freeze in the months ahead.
And some of this is actually just reminding them.
I was going to say as well, there's also sort of an inventory component too. I mean, it's one thing to sort of say, okay, they went and intercepted two fighters, but it was almost like reminding everyone what was in the arsenal. So, you know, two MiG-31s, two Sukhoi Su-34s, one Su-27 flanker, and another two Sukhoi 24 as well. So I'm going to say, you know, okay, some people have said our arsenal is maybe a little bit rusty, a little bit shaky, but look, you know, we can get seven aircraft, you know, up over the Baltic.
We have all these modern aircraft, and
modernish,
compared to
1955
tanks. Yes, and one of them as well. It is. It's reminding these countries that they are, if the Russians really wanted to do it, pretty defenseless, and perhaps also hinting that, you know, the West has not actually done much in other parts, in other quarrels that we've been involved in, we Russia have been involved in. So don't necessarily count on that.
I think one interesting consequence that we're seeing more and more rumbling about is that Sweden, which has sat in the line about NATO, is feeling more and more inclined to join NATO because of this kind of saber rattling by Russia. So, you know, be careful what you begin, because you don't really know what the consequence will be.
That's also true, that it might have the exact opposite result of what Russia wants. But we don't really know what Russia wants in this context.
Well, I think we do. The return, the ascension of Tsar Vladimir Putin.
I'm just, Jim, from your perspective, from the diplomat seat, what do you think is happening if you are, I guess, defense attaché and you're sitting at the British Embassy in Moscow, or you are in, whether it's the French or the German Embassy as well, not quite what does one's day look like at the moment, but, you know, when we're in this type of period, when you have this, we can't really sort of call it saber rattling, but maybe sort of, you know, just slightly sort of trying to dip your hand into the quiver to see what arrows are there. What do you think is going on in Moscow, at least from the diplomat side of NATO nations?
Well, I think everybody will be trying to probe to see what information is available about real intentions. But it's always very difficult. And I think military things are particularly difficult. Defense attaches go around and they wear their uniforms and they are highly visible and they do go in for lots of ceremonial stuff, which actually limits what they can do in certain contexts. When I was in China in 1989, we had all the Western diplomats and particularly the defense staffs out on the streets, some in mufti, some not in mufti, just to try and get as much information as you can. Now, it's not nearly at that sort of stage, but the other thing is, over the years, if you've done your job properly, you've built up contacts within the military, within the Russian think tanks, and you'll be tapping into those. And in the end, you probably won't know the answer either.
I actually think, though, that long-term, the answer seems pretty clear, which is that Putin is on the wrong side of history. He's not going to be able to rebuild a greater Russia and sort of a son of Soviet Union.
No, I would agree with that entirely. The thing is, he's still relatively young, and he can go on for some time, and he can be a nuisance in reduce it to its lowest level in that time. But I think that the idea of recreating the Soviet Union, which after all was only a relatively short period, or the old Russian Empire, again, it's not really possible.
I want to, just before we go to a break, just jump to the other side of the world. And if we can go to Hong Kong, we're 1 month into these protests. Jim, this is at least sort of largely, at least part of your former patch. Is this a war of attrition? Does Beijing hope right now that, you know, every day there are 100 fewer protesters and they're just going to sort of, you know, wear them out and the side of commerce is going to win? Enough traders in Hong Kong are going to be angry enough to say, look, just get off the street. You know, we need to do what we do best here and get on with being an important business hub. What do you think happens?
Well, I think that will be the message from the business community in Hong Kong. You know, don't spoil it. Things are good, really. Okay, so we don't have Westminster-style elections, but we have a good life and the Chinese, by and large, leave us alone, so don't disturb it. That will be the message. That isn't necessarily going to cut much ice with those who have been on the streets and are willing to go on the streets again. But with all these things, attrition sets in. You get fed up. You're not getting anywhere. And so they drift away. Even in Beijing in 1989, by the time they actually went and cleared the square, the thing was beginning to break up. And if they'd only waited 4 days when the rains came down terribly heavily for 36 hours, the whole thing would have been washed out, but it was too late by then. But I think the Chinese are worried not so much about Hong Kong, that Hong Kong can sort out its own problems in a sense. We're here, we can put the PLA on the streets if necessary, but we don't really want to. But they're worried about the knock-on effect in other bits of China. I mean, China is not the same as it was 20 years ago. People now have much more access to information. I know there's censorship still, and I know there's restrictions, but the amount of information that's flowing in is so much greater. And that worries the authorities, I think, in Beijing, that people in other bits of China who are disgruntled, and not just in the classic areas like Tibet and Xinjiang, but other places too, there are grievances and complaints, and people don't like the way the Communist Party does things. So the message will go around, well, you can have protests and you can do that. And that worries them because that's a challenge to the party and to the system.
Jeff, I mean, do you have a sense of what percentage are, and I'm talking, you know, of mainlanders who are sitting on the edge of their seat, sort of egging this on, wanting, hungry for more information to really sort of see how this plays out and plays out in the face of Beijing?
I can't claim to be an expert or quantify something like that, but clearly there's a growing appetite for these things. To me, what's interesting in following the latest twists and turns in Hong Kong, James Chen, the leader of the Liberal Party in Hong Kong, who's just resigned because he called on
the chief executive mm-hmm. to step down because he wasn't handling all this and he was messing up the administration of Hong Kong. He has resigned. And what's so interesting, and it's just another reminder that I think the two of you know this so well, that the cultural differences between Western politics and politics in that part of the world, he was apologetic. He was contrite. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't have said that. And that kind of thing, it was this, you know, here's this clothing magnet worth with millions and millions of dollars, one of the most powerful men in Hong Kong, getting his wrist slapped by mainland China and saying, I am so sorry, I misspoke, forgive me. And you just, you know, those are not the kind of words you would expect even from a politician here in the UK or elsewhere in the West to say when he annoyed people.
But most Western politicians wouldn't be quite so economically vulnerable as somebody like he is. I mean, mm-hmm. as you say, he's got another big fire going up the road, and that the Chinese could do things about if they wanted to.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to go away for a short break. My guests today, Geoffrey Kaufman and Jim Hoare. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back right after this.
With a global network of bureau and correspondents, Monocle has just opened up its newest regional base in the heart of Istanbul. Dedicated to covering the Eastern Mediterranean, Central Asia, and the Middle East, Joseph Dana is our man in Istanbul.
Separated by the Bosphorus Strait and spanning two continents, Istanbul has always been an ideal place to survey the region and make sense of the ever-changing puzzle that is the Middle East. From reports at the Syrian border to commentary from the ground in the Gaza Strip, we have you covered in this rapidly changing patch at the center of the international media.
From Ankara to Almaty, Tel Aviv to Tashkent, Joseph Dana is Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief and our correspondent for the region. Catch his reports on The Globalist and our other daily flagship programs and across our weekly magazine shows right here on Monocle 24.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Studio One here in Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24. Still with me is Jim Hoare, academic, historian and ex-diplomat and London-based writer and former news correspondent, still news correspondent, always a news correspondent, right, Geoffrey?
Once and always. It's always in your blood.
I want to just turn to our attention to, well, travel bans, and certainly as they concern Ebola at the moment, the reaction of national governments. We've had a few countries' policies have come under attack, certainly over the weekend, for being discriminatory and counterproductive. Australia and the US have respectively introduced travel bans and mandatory quarantines. Just before we go to the topic, I want to just play a small clip from the Australian Immigration Minister, Scott Morrison.
These measures include, Madam Speaker, temporarily suspending our immigration program, including our humanitarian program, from EBV-affected countries. And this means we are not processing any application from these affected countries.
I mean, Jim Hoare, we shouldn't really be too surprised by that. That was the Immigration Minister for Australia, Scott Morrison. There, I mean, you know, anyone who goes into Australia, I mean, you get, you know, frisked, and they sort of deploy a battalion of beagles and everything else. So maybe not so surprising from them, but these types of measures, typical of what one might expect, from the likes of the US, and I mean, that's a whole other Homeland Security story. or you know, is it sort of their right to really sort of do what they want, and are they out of step, or do we see perhaps other people sort of falling in line with them?
Well, of course, most countries can impose a health regime of some sort or other. Flying in and out of Beijing year after year, several times a year, you would be instructed to fill in a health form and you would hand it in, and God knows what they did with them. So, you know, you were supposed to write down if you had any symptoms, and I never saw anybody actually look at these things. So it's pretty casual often. And when you get this sort of outbreak, I suppose the avian flu a few years back was the one that started the latest round of let us panic because something might happen.
Yes, hence all the thermal cameras all over the world
And it's generally thought that that was, if you'll pardon the expression, overkilled, or rather it was underkilled. Nobody got killed. I think it's the Australian reaction and the United States reaction is perhaps a reflection of the general attitude towards immigrants anyway. Just as we here have introduced some sorts of controls. I haven't been through an airport recently, so I don't know what they are, but they're apparently very selective. And clearly, Ebola is not very selective if you get exposed to it.
I feel more passionately. I'm just appalled by what Australia has done. I think it is the worst political pandering. This is politics trumping science. The head of the Australian Medical Association has denounced this and said there just isn't the medical evidence to back this up. And Tony Abbott, the Prime Minister, has said, well, thank you very much for your opinion. I mean, this is, you know, the U.S., which in New Jersey and New York imposed similar kinds of, well, these harsh quarantines last week, has backed off that. And Obama has quite rightly said, you know, we can't. If we tighten the screws on movement, we're going to tighten the screws on humanitarian relief, on doctors and nurses going. Ultimately, the only way Ebola is going to be contained if we get it at the source. And if the Western countries with the most sophisticated medicine, like Australia and the United States, stop the movement between the countries, we are going to face an epidemic, because Ebola will not be contained and will not be eradicated. I think it is just it goes against all the values that we as enlightened Westerners want to believe that we stand for, at least many of us.
But, you know, just yesterday or the day before, Britain announced that it's not going to engage in search and rescue in the Mediterranean. It all goes with the same sort of attitude. I agree. I find it appalling. I wasn't praising it, because I think, A, I don't think it works, and B, I think it is a symptom of broader attitudes.
It is. It's almost, you know, it's almost as if the politicians are saying, let them die. It really is. And I look at the humanitarian relief workers from Médecins Sans Frontières and the volunteers from the UK, the US, and elsewhere who go in there. And, you know, and I can't stand as a journalist the word heroes. I think it's the most hackneyed, cloying, you know, saccharine term, and so inappropriately used so often. But, you know, I'm prepared to call these volunteers heroes, because, you know, it is incredibly brave. And even the journalists who go in, you know, especially given what's gone on in terms of the quarantines and you know, an NBC cameraman dying, you know, there clearly is huge peril. And to make it worse and to scare these people off and to discourage people from going because you'd be quarantined and stigmatized, you know, this American medical doctor who, you know, even the New York Times putting in maps of his movements through New York and the subways he was on, it only contributes to hysteria when there's no evidence that simply standing next to him on a subway is going to give you Ebola.
No, except it's not that, I don't think. I think it is, we don't want foreigners coming into our country if we can possibly avoid it. And you can say things in the context of a disease that you might not want to say in the context of ordinary people moving around the world.
I wanted to just get your view, both of you, probably before we go. Samantha Power's trip to Africa as well. How you sort of viewed that, I guess, Jeffrey, as part sort of, you know, fact-finding mission, or how much of it is not set dressing, but, you know, obviously the U.S. administration saying, you know, let's get her out there. It's important to, of course, see a, you know, high-profile diplomat, and certainly one who has a seat at the U.N. doing a tour. But I think, how do you think that has played out, I guess, domestically? Because, I mean, that could have been a story that you could have been on in your ABC days.
You know, I think that what's really interesting when you read it is that Obama, you know, is saying these incredibly sensible things about Ebola, that we're not going to have knee-jerk panic. And you know, and Samantha Powers is clearly reflecting that in her travels. And yet, you know, the sad thing we know, and we've talked about it before around this table, is that unfortunately Obama's voice is not being heard very well in the U.S. these days.
Yeah. Just last word to you, Jim Hoare.
I hadn't really sort of considered it. I'm not always terribly impressed by high-level visits to solve very complex problems. But it does, I suppose it does give more publicity. It does raise the profile. And it is right that government should be properly informed.
Mm. We promised our listeners at the very top of the show we were going to get to Erdogan and to Turkey. That did not happen. But at least we...
The palace. We have to talk about the palace.
Okay, 2 seconds.
Very outrageous. $350 million for a palace for the president of Turkey, and massive unemployment and 20% youth unemployment. I mean, what is going on? It speaks of what's wrong.
If you've come from Pyongyang, where the palace has been... similar sort of palace, not a similar sort of architecture either, has been turned into a double palace and really into a double mausoleum. This is peanuts.
It's a snip. We're going to have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman, Jim Hoare, thanks very much for joining us. If you're listening to Midori House, news headlines are coming up in a moment.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
to Berlin,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Just gone slightly adrift of the bottom there. It's 1831 here in Studio One at Midori House. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll take a look at Citibike, Boeing, and a floating train with our transport editor in New York. And then we're in Finland to meet the world's funniest man. But first, here's Suzanne Chislett with the bottom there headlines.
Thank you, Tyler. The World Health Organization says the number of new Ebola cases in Liberia may have plateaued. Figures suggest there have been fewer burials and confirmed positive lab tests in recent weeks, the first sign that the efforts to halt the spread of the virus in the worst affected nations is making progress. Iraqi security forces say they are now within a few miles of the city of Baiji, following a renewed offensive to try to retake the country's biggest oil refinery. It's been largely in control of Islamic State militants since June. The search for 300 people missing after a landslide in Sri Lanka is continuing. At least 100 are known to have died after heavy monsoon rains buried a village in the central tea-growing region. And the French government has denied claims by Russia that it's going ahead with the delivery of the first Mistral-class assault ship next month. The €1.2 billion deal was delayed earlier this year after international pressure on Paris over Moscow's role in the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
And you're listening to Midori House, and it's just gone 21:33 in Moscow. It's 18:33 here in London. It's 16:33 in Rio de Janeiro. It's now time to check in with one of our editors or correspondents around the world. We're going to jump across the Atlantic. Tristan McAllister, a gentleman I was on the road with all over the Asia-Pacific region last week, is back at base. Hello, Tristan.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Great.
Well-traveled.
Yes, well-traveled and now well-rested. I'm feeling good.
Okay, so why don't we talk transport themes, and maybe we should, just go beyond your windows and maybe talk two-wheel transport. A story about Citibike and an ownership change. And I guess for those who aren't familiar with Citibike, set it up for us.
Well, City Bike, of course, was the brand new bike sharing scheme that was unveiled last year here in New York City. It stations all over Lower Manhattan, or mostly Lower Manhattan, also in Brooklyn. Nice blue City Bike bikes were set and locked for people to use as a bike share setup. So what you saw was a bit of languishing, a lot of people, a lot of excitement initially, and then numbers were tapering off in terms of people renewing their $95 memberships. People got concerned. There were issues over the locks. There were issues with availability. And the city said they really liked having it there, but they weren't quite sure about its viability and said they were afraid to invest more money until there was a clear way forward. Now we've seen that someone thinks there's a clear way forward. The company that is overseeing the program has now been bought out. It should be noted too, Tyler, that they were purchased by a bit of a tie-up between Related, which is a big property group here in New York, and also well-known spa or fitness centers, Equinox. And they will be taking it on, pumping a lot of money into it, and asking City Bike for $70 million more dollars to keep the program going.
And so when you were talking about that funding request, Tristan, is that money coming from, because we should probably sort of say that it's City, C-I-T-I, as in the bank. So are they going back to the financial institution to say, we're taking this over, but if your name's going to be on it, you have to cough up more?
Right, exactly. And the initial sort of input was $40 million from Citibank for Citibike, C-I-T-I. And they have been asked to cough up $70 million more. I'm assuming that was contingent upon some sort of plan. They've put a czar or some sort of executive in place to make sure that things go as they should. And they're also raising membership dues. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes. But in general, people feel pretty good about the Citibikes here, Tyler. So I just think that they need to get some more money, make the system a little more extensive, and hopefully people will start to get back on track with it.
And how do you feel as transport editor? You're traveling all over the world. You see these various bike sharing schemes. Do you think it's hit in the way that it should, or would you like to see, you know, more people commuting to work, going between, you know, a meeting and a dinner date on them as well?
Oh, well, often Vélib in Paris is used as a really good example here. They have twice as many bikes on the streets as the City Bike program does here, up around 20,000 in Paris. Here, actually, it's just around 6,000. They want to take it to 12, so not nearly as much as Paris. It's been successful there. Also, Alta Bike, the company that has overseen City Bike so far, also does the bike sharing schemes in Melbourne. They do them in Boston. They do them in Toronto, in Washington, D.C., Seattle. They've been successful in those places. It really is about making it part of the mix, Tyler. It's not just about saying, oh, City Bike's is going to be the only way you get around. One thing they've done in Paris that's been very successful is they've sort of included in the cost of your monthly transit pass also, in some cases, the use of the bikes. They've not done that here, not that integrated, but something like that could really bring it forward. And to answer your question, yes, I think this does work. It does get people on the streets. It does make the streets more sort of lifestyle friendly, and I think that's what everyone's hoping for.
Let's stay reasonably close to ground. Anyone who's been following the world of rails and guided tracks will know that a couple of weeks ago, the Japanese government are going to go ahead with their magnetic levitation train between Tokyo, Nagoya to start. It will eventually go on to Osaka. But there looks like potentially with the Northeast Corridor in the United States, this might come as well. I don't know. I mean, I think you have to give us your view, because we've been hearing about that high-speed train in California, and I haven't been able to buy my tickets yet. So what's happening?
Well, I think the promising thing to think about here, Tyler, is that it is at this point a private venture. And from my perspective here in the U.S. and talking with people, not only rail officials, but the dreamers, the wealthy people who want to put up the money to do this on the private end of the spectrum, it seems that the private might be the way to go in terms of a red tape, in terms of dealing with partisan fighting over rail funds. What you mentioned here, of course, is this proposed maglev train to connect New York and Washington, D.C. What's interesting here is that the railway in Japan Central Railway, has actually said they would put up $5 billion to start the project and get that lag between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, which is on the way to New York, going. So, you know, there are people here putting their money where their mouth is, but still, in terms of environmental impact statements, in terms of rights of way,
these can get very, very complicated. And we've seen that again and again in the U.S. And, you know, high-speed rail doesn't seem to stick like it should here.
Yeah, and it's a little bit more difficult, I think, also from a construction point of view. You're not just going on existing tracks. These things have to be elevated.
Brand new infrastructure.
Yeah, I'm not buying my pass just yet. Fonz, before we go, we're sort of floating, but we'll take flight. Interesting thing you picked up. Boeing delivers its 100th 777 to Emirates. I mean, this is just quite staggering.
100th 777-300ER to Emirates.
Yeah,
so they
not just any old 777. So yeah, everyone should probably know this is amongst the longest range, or at least longest range combined with the largest passenger capacity anyway of that type.
And freight capacity of its type. And so, you know, this is a huge milestone. Emirates has been a proud customer of the 777 for some time, and they use it really as the backbone of their fleet, although most people think of the A380 when they think of Emirates. But just think about what this is in terms of the U.S. economy. Right now, they have... They're saying that this airplane, the 204 that Emirates has on order from Boeing at this point, in addition to what they already have, supports over 400,000 jobs in the U.S. So this is huge here. And when we think about sort of global aviation, and we think about the rising Middle Eastern carriers, and you know the carriers that frankly are making a lot of the American and European carriers angry because they're you know wading in on their territory. When you think about the economic impact that these carriers are having on economies, not only in Europe with Airbus. But economies here in the U.S. with manufacturing. It's just a massive equation. And 100 of those jets, that's a lot of really big airplanes to maintain.
Tristan McAllister, our transport editor in New York. We're going to have to leave it there. We are going to stay in New York, though, after this very short break. We'll be talking to our friend Pim Fox from Bloomberg. Stay with us.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show.
I look at it and I think, God, could I have really lived like that? Could it have really been me? But I know that it was, so I do connect with it.
Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House here in Monocle 24. Just gone 1842 in London. It's 1442 in New York. Almost means it's probably time to check in with our Pim Fox. Not our Pim Fox. He's Bloomberg's Pim Fox. But he's certainly a friend of the program here. And we just should probably set up what we're going to talk about. News from Bloomberg today that WhatsApp, and everyone, of course, will know that that's the mobile messaging app that Facebook acquired for an absolutely bonkers $22 billion. This company only generated $10.2 million in revenues last year. Pim, hello. Help us unravel this.
Well, you see, now here, you have to get in with the new math, man. I mean, this is, you know, this is the world where, okay, we're gonna suspend a kind of, commonsensical judgment because, you know, ultimately none of these companies are really, like, selling anything. They are selling airtime on the internet, right? I mean, they're selling your eyeballs so that you will go and buy things and do things and you can be separated from your money without really knowing. Noticing it. Now, it just before we get to the WhatsApp acquisition and the $22 billion, here's kind of the way I want you to think about this. Imagine that there was a company that did $11,000 in business or 11,000 pounds in business a month, right? Maybe you sold 11,000 pounds worth of candy, 11,000 euros worth of, balloon items and, you know, Halloween masks, whatever it is. And then at the end of that month, out of that 11,000 that you washed through your system, you kind of looked in the drawer and you realized, oh, there's 2,700. There's 2,700 euros, dollars, pounds left. So out of 11, you're getting more than 2.5. So the reason you have to sort of wrap your mind around that first is because that is what Facebook does. Facebook does about more than $11 billion in revenue. Now, I got you. I mean, you know, what do they actually do? Well, they sell this virtual space to advertising companies, and they do it online in a way that allows you to access it through your, you know, mobile phone. And yes, we know that 66% of all the advertising that they have is on mobile. And yes, that's all great. And, you know, you walk down the street and everyone's got their head pitched forward, looking slightly down. And why? Because everyone's staring at these stupid screens all day long. But having said that, clearly, advertisers believe that it is worth spending $11.2 billion a year on Facebook. It's estimated to go up to more than $12 billion next year. And then, when all is said and done, when they do all whatever it is they do at Facebook, and you know, however many hooded sweatshirts they buy, they still have $2.7 billion in net income at the end of the year. Now, going to your WhatsApp thing. All right, $22 billion. Well, what's the reality of the $22 billion? The $22 billion is Facebook stock. So, number one, this was currency that, as you know, gets created in the world of the initial public offering and the financial markets, where if not everybody sells, it's worth exactly what the last price was, right? I mean, it's like, you know, you can't go and sell every bit of soap all at the same time. You sell them one by one and so on. So is it a failure? Who knows? There was a statement coming out of Facebook that says, you know, the reality is, what do they have? This WhatsApp thing, I think they got 453 million registered users. And in today's world, I know it's frightening, but Facebook says, you know what? We don't really worry about making the monies until we get a billion users. Isn't that, that's kind of scary. Mm. Nevertheless, I don't know, man. Maybe you can sell something to Facebook. I mean, they seem to be wanting to buy almost anything, and they'll pay these astronomical prices. I think the window's open here for you, man.
It might be, but they probably already know that I'm probably the biggest non-user. Pim, we're going to have to leave it there. We should always sort of give you a full half hour. Maybe we need the Pim Fox show here on Monocle 24. That was Pim Fox from Bloomberg's Taking Stock in New York. And you're still with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, it's home to Santa Claus, Pinewoods, and I guess what's left of Nokia, but it's not exactly known for its humor. Well, Finnish people rejoice. You can now lay claim to the world's funniest person. An international humor competition hosted by Las Vegas's Laugh Factory has awarded Finland's Ismo Lekkola the title of world's number one jokester, just ahead of the entries from, wait for it, Pakistan and France. Well, a bit earlier, our resident Finn Marcus Hippi and our executive producer Tom Edwards caught up with Ismo to see what makes Finns laugh.
One of the things I wanted to ask you first was about the difficulty of translating humor across borders. It's something a lot of comedians talk about. What are the particular challenges? Are there things about Finnish humor which are unique to that country that maybe don't travel so well?
Most jokes I come up with in Finnish doesn't translate, but there's lots of stuff that does. So, like, I had to start the whole thing all over when I changed the language to English. It was just like trial and error for first years. And now it's like interchangeable much more.
Oh, that's good to hear, Ismo. By the way, I'm obviously Finnish as well, and that's exactly what I've been struggling here in Finland as well, when I sometimes realise that for some reason people who are not from Finland seem to think that Finland is a somewhat humour-free zone. So, yeah, I think it's great to hear that you've actually managed to break the language barrier and crack jokes in English.
In the beginning, it seemed impossible, but it is possible. So, and also, that was the first time I went to America to do gigs, and they got it as well.
Can I just ask for your view? Do you think Finnish sense of humour is different from humour you are faced with abroad?
I don't know if the humour is different. Comedians are really different. Like, every comedian is like an individual also here and every country. So I don't know if there's like a big theme of type of humour in Finland particularly.
Ismo, can I try? Because I've been doing my research. I've got a couple of jokes about Finns. So I'd like to try one out. And then maybe you could fire back a joke about maybe someone from the UK. And we'll see how it compares and what it tells us. This is one that I rather liked. What's the difference between a Finnish wedding and a Finnish funeral? at the funeral, there's one less drunk.
Yeah, well, that's...
It doesn't sound like you like that one very much, Ismo.
Yeah, it's good. But also, the deceased can be drunk if he died drunk, so there will be alcohol.
And so tell me, what about the jokes that got the best laughs? Were you aware of the jokes that got the biggest laughs when you were there? Was it about drinking? What things worked best for you when you were doing your set?
Well, the great thing was that almost everything worked really well. So, I don't know what was the best. Yeah, maybe one was really good about in UK and America, that people, when they want to insult somebody, they start to insult their mother instead. Weird to finish people.
Well, let's have one of those examples, Ismo. It's perfectly right. We can say that. We've got a very kind of easy kind of licensing here on Monarch 24. We can use any sorts of language and colour that we like. So what was the examples that you gave?
In Finland, we don't ever say that. We don't even get it. We wouldn't even. If somebody would say to a Finnish person that, oh, your mom is a fat, rich idiot, I think we would probably be like, so where do you know her from?
Ismo, I don't know where Thomas got that document from, but in front of him, he's got a sheet that's full of jokes about Finland. I think, Tommy, you want to share one more with us.
Well, this is one of my favourites, Ismo. I don't know what you make about this one. What's the difference between Sweden and Finland? And the answer is, the Swedes have really nice neighbours.
Yeah.
Ismo is not laughing.
Ismo, it's really offending me. Why are you not laughing at my brilliant jokes?
I'm trying to struggle with the phone line because that's the punchline, but I'm laughing internally.
That's very polite of you. Thank
you. You know, I was going to share one joke with you as well, because Tom was asking about this earlier, what my jokes are, and I always tend to forget about them, but I do have one I actually remember now, if I can still share it with you, and we may get maybe some feedback from Ismo as well. So here we go. I went to the zoo the other day, and there was only one dog in it. It was a Shih Tzu.
That's quite good, Marcus. What do you think of that, Ismo? What would you give that out of 10?
8 out of 10.
Oh, 8 out of 10. That's pretty good. Can I just give you one of my favourite... This is a very English joke, and you can see... I think this will defeat Marcus's one, but you can be the judge. This is a classic English one. What's brown and sticky? A stick.
Yeah, that's nice.
I sense, again, no, I'm not going to... Is that better than Marcus's one?
Well, yeah, I think that's 8.5.
Tom Edwards wins it by a half point.
Before we let you go, can you tell me about the reaction you've got in your home country, Finland? How happy are people over there about you winning this title?
Yeah, people have been like unbelievably like happy. It's been like in every single paper in the country, and it's like people have really, really excited about it. So it's been a big thing for. I think for Finland in general and the whole comedy, because I don't know if Finnish comedy has ever been exported outside the borders. There's been lots of music and stuff, but never comedy, except your jokes now.
Ismo Laikola, look, congratulations once again. A superb achievement. Thanks so much for joining us. And when you're next in London, you'll have to come and visit us here at Midori House.
Ismo Laikola, the world's funniest man, talking to our resident Finn, Marcus Hippie, and Tom Edwards. You're listening to Midori House. Just 1853 here in London. Time now for our daily arts review. Today we're talking television, and joining me here in the studio to catalogue the highs and lows. Maybe they're all highs, maybe they're all lows. We'll hear in a moment. Jasper Rees is here, writer at the Arts Desk. Jasper, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you, Tyler.
Very good to see you. You've got three programmes for us. You've got The Missing, the new BBC series, Grantchester, which is out on the ITV network, and then also Gotham as well. So I don't know if we want to go top to bottom, but what do you want to start with?
Why don't we start with Gotham?
Okay.
Which I was so not expecting to enjoy, because I'm really not into kind of sort of humans impersonating comic
right
characters, but boy is it a hoot. It's just such fun. Essentially the idea is that you they've done a film of a television series of young Indiana Jones, they've done the young Sherlock, there's even been a whole three films about the young Darth Vader. This is about the young Bruce Wayne, and the kind of the interesting thing is the young Bruce Wayne isn't actually in it very much. He's played by a young actor called David Mazouz, and he's we see his parents being murdered in the first episode. But mainly it's about attempting to find out who killed his parents. Mm. And Commissioner Gordon is merely Detective Gordon in this series. He's played by Ben McKenzie, who your listeners may remember from The OC.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the kind of archetypally clean cop who enters this exceptionally corrupt world of Gotham City, where, as he's told by his superior, you don't bend, you break. And everyone is deliciously bent.
Mm.
Jada Pinkett Smith plays a fantastic, very, very scary sort of dominatrix, a criminal sort of drug lady.
Mm.
And there's just pleasure wherever you look. It's beautifully filmed. It makes New York look, takes New York back to the sleazy 70s. Mm.
And pitched as family viewing or over 14s?
The body count is pretty high, it has to be said. Mm. And there are some, I mean, it's kind of comedy violence, but some of the stuff is really quite graphic.
Mm.
There's a moment where Jada Pinkett Smith's character, she's being tested for her loyalty to someone, a sort of mafioso Don figure. And mm. So she has to watch her young busboy boyfriend being beaten up, and so do we. And it's really quite unpleasant. But it is, so I wouldn't necessarily encourage anyone under the age of, say, 12
okay.
to watch it. But,
all right, you've heard the parents' warning here. Tell us about the missing, and this has been getting certainly a lot of by anyone who's been close to sort of BBC One or any of the BBC channels domestically have seen certainly a lot of promos for this.
The missing is nowhere is it mentioned in the publicity, but mm. it's impossible, certainly if you're watching in the UK, to consume it without thinking of the famous and extremely upsetting case of Madeleine McCann, a British child who was abducted in Portugal about 8 years ago now, I think. And pretty much exactly the same thing happens in this, except that the child is a boy, slightly older, and it happens in France. But as written by Harry and Jack Williams, who are two brothers who write together, it's, the scene in which the child is abducted is, I mean, it's extremely harrowing to watch. What they've done is perhaps out of deference to the McCanns, they've introduced a lot of really implausible plot twists to sort of take it away from the ghastliness of reality. Mm. It stars James Nesbitt.
And this is a contained series that it runs. It's how many parts?
It's 8 parts, and it's the big BBC One drama of the season. And,
right.
It'll get a lot of people watching it. You do,
but it's contained. I mean,
it is contained. There won't be another series. I wouldn't have thought. I got to the end of the first episode thinking, well, I don't believe much of this, but I sure as hell want to know what happens next.
I will, just before we go, and in maybe about 45 seconds, Grantchester, and this is the ITV network here, set up in Cambridgeshire. Tell us first, where does it rank? 1, 2, or 3, if I had to tune into it, if I had to, all 3 shows.
Oh, 2. It's kind of basically Inspector Morse meets The Killing. So it's set in.
I'll tune in. That sounds good.
It's set
I like
in.
That.
It's set in near Cambridge or in Cambridgeshire, a very flat, boring part of the world. But and so it has that a sort of a lovely sort of 50s feel to it. The detective is a vicar. The books, it's based on books written by the son of the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's called James Runcie. But you can never forget that the Fenlands are adjacent to Denmark, which is where, as we know, a lot of people end up horizontal.
sounds like a very promising one. Jasper Rees from the Arts Desk. We're going to have to leave it there. That's all the time we have for today's edition of Midori House. Many thanks in particular to our earlier guest, Jeffrey Kaufman, and former diplomat Jim Hoare. Today's show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by David Pleasant and Muriel Awaji. And our studio manager today has been Joel Church. After these headlines, Mr. Giacopelli is back with today's edition of The Entrepreneurs. And at 2200, Emma Nelson is going to be here, also with Peter Cardwell. And of course, this show is back at the very same time at 1800 tomorrow. But for me, Tyler Berlay, it's goodbye. Have a good evening.
From London, To New York.
To Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.